it's good.
But the deal doesn't work
together.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. Colleagues, we're going to go a little bit out of order today on our agenda. We'll start by announcing once again we have found a few issues in the amendments with 2801 and 2893. I'm going to hold those bills over while we get those resolved. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2266. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2266 allows the Public Utility Commission to set by rule filing dates for public utility budgets, budget documents, clarifies which regulation are related to water utilities.
Colleagues, what's your pleasure on this bill? This is the one we heard earlier from Mr. Eisdorfer, Public Utility Commission. My understanding is this bill is ready to go and is a technical fix.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Boone moves House Bill 2266 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Vice Chair Johnson, we are about to vote on House Bill 2266.
Great.
Seeing no further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Denbrough?
Excused.
Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Megan Peterson?
2266.
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. 2266 is on its way to the floor. Representative Widener, would you carry? Thank you. Representative Widener will carry. And close the work session on House Bill 2266. Open public hearing, House Bill 2049A. And we'll just get the sign-up sheet here.
2049, which one's it?
I'm sorry, Senate Bill.
Senate Bill.
249A. It's been a long day. Let me clarify. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 249A. Oh, those tricky Senate bills. Call up Palmer Mason and Randy Tucker, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. Senate Bill 249 comes to you unanimously out of the Senate, and the genesis of this bill was that I was approached by some of my colleagues shortly before the short session last year to try to address this concern, and there was broad support for addressing this the concern that's addressed by this bill that I'll explain in a second, but there wasn't enough time, and we couldn't find a bill with a relating clause, et cetera. So we worked together with a coalition that includes the Oregon Environmental Council, the Oregon Trucking Associations, Northwest Natural, the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, and the DEQ and Metro, of course, to bring this legislation before you today. It's a pretty simple bill. All it does is, there's federal money available for addressing diesel emissions. And it's under the Federal Diesel Emissions Reduction Act that has its own rules and requirements and limitations. There's also an Oregon diesel program. I forget the title of it. Paul Palmer will give you the exact name, I'm sure. And it has its own rules and regulations and limitations. And those are stricter than the limitations on the federal program. So we've found ourselves in a situation where there isn't much we can do with federal dollars, even though there are plenty of things we could still do to address diesel emissions in Oregon. And so what this bill does is basically it says that the money that's available from the federal government, you have to apply for it, under the Diesel Emissions Reduction Act, can be spent the way the federal government allows you to spend it without the further restrictions that are imposed on the state program, the state dollars. And so, as I say, this has broad support across the spectrum and no known opposition, and I urge you to give it an aye vote and move it onto the floor. All right, one last thing to say. The reason Metro is interested specifically is because of our interest in, we manage the solid waste system in the Portland region at the sort of the wholesale level, and so we're interested in the use of federal dollars to help address emissions from diesel garbage trucks. Thanks.
So, Chair Mason. Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason, the Government Relations Manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'd like to echo what Randy said. This has been a collaborative effort to bring what I think is really a good public policy bill to the legislature. That is Senate Bill 249. Basically, in 2007, the legislature passed the Clean Diesel Initiative Program at DEQ, and it was it used tax credits and general fund dollars to reduce the emissions from diesel engines. And the particulate emissions that come from diesel engines are some of the most common pollutants that we have, particularly in more urbanized areas of the state. So there was a lot of interest in addressing public health and environmental concerns by reducing the emissions from diesel engines. Up to this point, most of the qualifying projects have been diesel engine retrofits. But what we would like to do is, as Randy explained, track the federal guidelines, which would allow us, if the legislature were to approve, use the dollars for a broader suite of projects. It wouldn't just be diesel engine retrofits, it could be for other things. So maybe a simple example would be, under current law, if there were a school bus where we were concerned about emissions, we would be limited to retrofitting that engine, as opposed to helping, under like the federal guidelines, helping the school district buy a new vehicle. And as you probably could appreciate, newer vehicles have fewer emissions as well as run more efficiently. So that's the proposal here, is simply to allow DEQ to use the money for the projects that would be authorized under federal law. I should point out to the committee that the only dollars that we're talking about now are federal funding. The general fund dollars from the state of Oregon have been eliminated for the clean diesel program, and so the only dollars that remain are federal dollars, and that's the dollars we're talking about using for a broader purpose. So we would urge the committee to support the bill as well.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I named a lot of other organizations that support the legislation, and usually I don't speak for others, but I wanted to just call your attention to a letter that was submitted several days ago that has signatures of all those organizations on it. So it should be in OLIS with you.
Yeah. And if I may, Chair Bailey, one other thing. I passed out to the committee this side-by-side that shows you how the dollars could be spent under current law and then what would be allowed if this bill were to be passed and enacted by legislature.
Okay. Questions? And this came over unanimously from the Senate. Is that correct?
That's right. Okay. 28 or 29 to 0. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious how much money is available that we might access under this.
It's $200,000 to the state, up to $1 million.
Would you come forward and please say it on the record?
Good afternoon. My name is Kevin Downing. I'm the Clean Diesel Program Coordinator at the Department of Environmental Quality. Chair Bailey, Representative Benz. There's two funding streams under the federal legislation. One is an allocation that goes directly to the states that typically has been about $200,000 a year. There's also competitive funding available that may be up to as much as $1 million available within the region. So that's the scale of the money that we're looking at here.
Well, please, is there a matching requirement?
Only on, Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, on the state money, if we can show that there's the same amount of money that the feds are offering in the base allocation, then they will give us, that's being spent at the state level, then we will get half again as much more. On the competitive grants, one of the factors for consideration about whether a project is funded competitively is whether there's matching money that's brought to the table as well.
follow up?
Please.
Do we already have funds that would fit that match at this point?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, as Palmer has had in the first year of the program, we had allocated $1 million in general fund. We didn't spend it quite fast enough to meet the recession, so we had to reabsorb a couple hundred thousand dollars of that. And since that time, there's been no general fund at the state level. What I have been doing in the meantime to show a state match is to talk others into bringing their money to the table, like Metro, that put in a sizable amount of money that allowed us to match the federal dollars and generate more income into the state.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you to this panel. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 249A? Seeing none, close the public hearing on House Bill, Senate Bill 249A, and open a work session on Senate Bill 249A.
Chair Bailey, I move Senate Bill 249A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves Senate Bill 249A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on this measure. Seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Dembrough.
Aye.
Representative Reardon.
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Whitsitt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Chair Bailey.
Aye. Motion carries. And it's on its way to the floor. Volunteers to carry. And I'll jump in at once. Representative Widener, a twofer. All right. You can get gold star by your name. Representative Widener will carry.
Bill should be.
That's right.
He was gone all last week.
That's right. It makes it for being gone. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 249A. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2818. Do we have anybody signed up to testify on this? We do not. Is there anybody who wishes to be heard on House Bill 2818? Seeing none, I think this is a study bill that may not be going places. We'll see what happens. Close public hearing on House Bill 2818. It's not my intention to hold a work session on this today, so we'll touch back on it later. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2941. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2941 raises total solar photovoltaic nameplate capacity to 40 megawatts, attributes 20 megawatts to single solar projects that produce no more than 5 megawatts of alternating current, with the remaining 20 megawatts attributable to projects owned or leased by the Oregon Military Department, or OMD. Affirms OMD ownership of any renewable energy certificates associated with projects owned or leased by OMD, sets minimum solar photovoltaic generating capacity standard, exempts electric utilities serving fewer than 25,000 customers in Oregon and headquartered in another state from minimum solar photovoltaic generating capacity standard. There is a dash one amendment associated with this. It includes projects limited license to OMD to 20 megawatts attributable.
I'd like to call up Colonel Rees and Lieutenant Colonel Safe, please.
Representative or Chair Bailey, members of the committee, on behalf of the Adjutant General and Brigadier General Caldwell, who are down the hall testifying on the budget at the Ways and Means Committee, I'm Colonel Christian Reese, the Director of Installations for the Oregon Military Department. With me is Lieutenant Colonel Ken Safe, our Construction and Facilities Management Officer. Included in your packet is a letter of support from the Department of Defense, as well as two others in support of this bill. The Oregon National Guard was selected 2 years ago to participate in the Secretary of the Army's Net Zero Initiative. This initiative is designed to explore three lanes, energy, water, and waste, in an attempt to find more sustainable solutions, reduce long-term costs, and provide better resilience to our global defense infrastructure in the future. The Oregon National Guard was the only National Guard entity selected for the pilot program, competing against larger active duty installations. And we were selected in two of the three lanes, energy statewide, and water at our Camp Rylea training site near Astoria, Oregon. We've been very successful in the water lane and hope to announce later this spring that Camp Rialea is the first installation in the Net Zero pilot program to meet the 2020 goals. For the energy effort, we enacted a threefold strategy of reduction, production, and education. After delving into the energy issues and receiving technical and limited financial assistance from the Secretary of the Army's Office and the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, we began to quantify our energy footprint both on the thermal side for heating and cooling loads and on the electrical side for lighting, office use, etc. We determined the Oregon National Guard energy footprint was approximately 25 megawatts from electricity. House Bill 2941 is designed to provide support toward that 25-megawatt goal. The bill's 20-megawatt requirement accounts for approximately 85% of that 25-megawatt goal. This number was selected to coincide with the amount of the Oregon Military Department energy load, which falls within investor-owned utility footprint. Given the roughly 31 million megawatt hours that PGE and Pacific Power delivered to their customers in 2011, the 35,000 megawatt hours we would generate accounts for approximately 0.1% of that load. Our 20-megawatt ask is designed to fall within the renewable portfolio standard and would account for approximately 0.5% of the energy PGE and Pacific Power are required to procure to meet RPS obligations. The Oregon Military Department has a great track record for delivering our projects on time. We have completed some smaller energy projects and have approximately 300 kilowatts of solar PV at our facility statewide. We've also received a $250,000 U.S. Forest Service grant for the design of 7 building-scale biomass projects and nearly $800,000 in federal funding for the execution of 2 of those 7 sites this year. We've been aggressive in our new construction projects, seeking LEED silver or gold designations, and looking to ground source heat pumps and other innovative measures to reduce our energy loads. In addition, our efforts over the last 2 years to define our energy requirements and build a path forward led to recognition in the governor's recently released 10-year energy action plan. This aggressive approach toward innovation has been absolutely essential to our business model, as my general fund budget for support of our 3 million square feet of infrastructure statewide has grown only $300,000 since 1989. This anemic 3.4% increase over a 24-year period makes it essential that we look for opportunities to keep our infrastructure viable. So in summary, we have an electric load of approximately 25 megawatts, of which 20 megawatts we are trying to accommodate through this House Bill 2941. The Oregon Military Department's intent is to move forward with a public-private partnership without using state general funds. Passage of this bill will allow us to work with the PUC to ensure ratepayer effects are balanced with military department goals. We hope to achieve a result which aligns with the Department of Defense Energy Security Strategy and places the Oregon Military Department in a better position to support the citizens of Oregon into the future. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you, Colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Safe.
Thank you, Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, and Vice Chair Boone, representatives. My name is Lieutenant Colonel Ken Safe. I'm also with the Oregon Military Department, and I'd like to reiterate and highlight some of the things that Colonel Reese said. The letter in front of you that is from the Department of Defense, Region 10, is a pretty, I think, important letter from our perspective in that it provides us with a much-needed boost to really emphasize what we're trying to do with the Net Zero Energy Program. We have been leaning forward very hard looking at this a strategy to achieve net zero, and we feel as a state agency that we can accomplish both the goals of the Department of Defense, specifically the Army Assistant Secretary's Office for Energy Installation and Environment, but we can also be that leader for state agencies and to help pave the way and find ways that we can model and determine for other state agencies the way that this can be done. Simultaneously, we're working on energy reduction programs, and as we speak, we've got other folks in other chambers that are looking at the energy security savings program that we can target many of the other sites throughout the state. Now, one of the challenges, of course, that we have is that we're scattered throughout the state. So with our many installations and the complexity of meeting this goal for a very geographically diverse site. I think, as Representative Bentz put it in the recent comment about how large some parts of the state are, this opportunity would give us a real benefit. So we appreciate a yes vote on this today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Questions for this panel? Representative Widener.
Yes. Since everybody's staying quiet, just real quick, you're currently using 28 megawatts of power is what it requires to run the location. Did I hear you right?
We estimate our load statewide at 25 megawatts annually. That's on the electric load.
Load, and you're wanting to go to 40 megawatts?
So the 25 megawatt load, we're asking in this bill to take about 85% of that, which would be 20 megawatts. That's what this bill is designed to bring. And that 85% is based on the amount of our electrical footprint that's within the two investor-owned utilities.
I could add to that. This bill adds 20 megawatts for the benefit of OMD, so it doesn't really target the existing 20 in the solar capacity standard that's there currently.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just don't understand the part that's being brought forth by the department, the 20 megawatts of alternating current attributable projects located on the site, owned or leased. It's the paragraph A, the 20 megawatts of AC must be attributed to single projects that produce no more than five. And I generally recall why this was there when this legislation first passed. I want to say back in 2009, or I can't remember really. But why is that there? What is the reason for the language in lines 10 and 11?
Representative Bentz, we'll have to follow up on that.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I want to say thank you for your service as well for the leadership that the Oregon Military Department has shown on creating a secure energy future for the state of Oregon. It's pretty remarkable, and I have to say that nationally, the defense industry and the military has been a real leader on this issue, and here locally you are at the forefront of our national efforts. So I want to thank you again for your efforts at advancing the conversation on renewable energy in this state.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thanks. Call up Scott Bolton and Marion Haynes, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. We serve about 550,000 customers across Oregon as Pacific Power. As an Army veteran and as a former member of the Oregon National Guard, I just want to echo the Chair's comments on just recognizing how forward-thinking the Department of Defense has been in some of their policies addressing energy efficiency and renewable energy. I think some of the work that they've done over the last few years, in particular in forward deployment situations, on the ground and looking at alternative fuels, alternative ways of creating electricity, has really been a benefit not to just to our troops who have been taking advantage of that, but also to advancing some of the research and development that we could hopefully commercialize down the road. Unfortunately, and I might have to drop and do 50 for coming out and opposing House Bill 2941, but 2941 is not the approach to take to accomplish some of these goals. If you'll allow me, I'd like to just kind of go through the bill a little bit and highlight some of the problems that we have with this legislation. But first off, it doubles a solar mandate created first in 2009, as Representative Bentz mentioned, that isn't even complete yet. My company still has a number of megawatts out there, I think just over 6.5 that we're still looking to acquire. And we'll actually be having requests for proposals out within the next few weeks that the military department or any other developer can bid into competitively. And that leads me to the next big problem or flaw with this legislation is that it really is very anti-consumer on its face, in that the additional 20 megawatts that would be required of our companies can only come, if you look at Section 1B, can only come from projects or on land leased by the Oregon Military Department. So right now, how we procure renewables, and particularly in the utility solar standard, is we will put out a request for proposals. We will let the marketplace bid into that and help deliver to us the lowest cost, best positioned projects to serve our customers. This would artificially limit that for quite a large number of megawatts in the state, and I think also raises a very troubling concern, which is we're investor-owned utilities, we're privately owned, but we're regulated by the state. But this is a situation where the state is saying you can only buy resources from one of our agencies. That's incredibly problematic, and I hope that that's something folks chew on as they consider this bill further. I would also want to point out that one of the components of this bill, and as I understand, a requirement of the military department, National Guard, in reflecting that they are meeting the net zero energy installation standard that they're trying to demonstrate through their pilot project, is to retain the renewable energy certificates from the generation of these projects. Now, this, as the potential buyer of this energy, it leads us down to a path that I know it's been a while since we visited on, but it creates a null power problem for the utilities who are buying what would otherwise be a renewable resource, but would not have the attributes of that renewable resource to demonstrate that it is indeed renewable, because those would be retained by the National Guard. And so a problem that I know we've talked about that still needs to be resolved as we deal with some of these different mandates. And then finally, I just want to point out that the final section here, Section 2.3, I think tries to provide some recognition or some squaring between the utilities requirements under the Renewable Portfolio Standard and the fact that the RECs will be retained by the military department. We can't understand quite how that would work. Just reading through it, it doesn't seem to sync up well with our understanding of how we would demonstrate compliance under the RPS. If nothing else, that's another section that needs a lot of work. Finally, you know, not to challenge the military's interpretation of what they believe their goals are, but I just want to highlight that their 25 megawatts of load service that they believe that they use across the state at their installations is a much bigger, it's a much different measure than the production that would come from 20 megawatts of solar. Depending on where it's located and the quality of the system, mm-hmm. you know, you're looking at, you know, 17-20% capacity factor. So the actual energy that they would receive and the RECs that they would receive will fall far short of that 20 megawatts, or even getting close to that 25 megawatts of load that they're trying to offset. So it's a pretty expensive way cost to our customers to advance down the road towards that goal. What I would like to finish up with is just to simply point back to the fact that we do have requests for proposals. We do acquire renewable energy. Those opportunities do exist to the Oregon Military Department and their partners in developing these projects. We're happy to sit down with them and walk through exactly how to participate in that, and hope that they can compete for our business. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Haynes.
Good afternoon, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Marian Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. We represent approximately 825,000 customers in the northern Willamette Valley. We also oppose House Bill 2941 and would agree with much of what my colleague said. Couple additional things that I would point out to you all is, if the goal is truly a no net zero installation, I'm not sure why a policy would be placed only on PGE and PacifiCorp customers. If it's the right policy for the state and for the department, we would tend to think that all Oregonians would share in that policy, and it shouldn't fall to only our customers. I would like to reiterate the point about the RFP process. We also have those kinds of processes. We have one that's out right now, and they are able to bid into those. It's important to have those types of processes so that folks are incented to continue to drive down the cost of installed solar. Ultimately, hopefully, solar will be a resource that's on par with others, and having those kinds of competitive bidding processes are important to continuing to drive down on those costs. I would note that we have met with the Oregon Military Department and discussed a previous iteration of some thinking around how to accommodate the Department of Defense net zero initiative. And I think there's a number of ways existing for the department to do so. They could at any time build a project, and under federal PURPA law, we would be required to purchase that power. That could happen at any time, even outside of an RFP process that's tied to this solar capacity standard. They haven't done that yet, and I think that perhaps the reason that we have this bill before us and we're not simply seeing projects being built now is the cost of those projects. And so trying to circumvent that process and add to the solar capacity standard is really just finding a way for PG and PacifiCorp customers here in Oregon to pay for the goal that the Department of Defense has set out for their net zero initiative. And we don't think that that's appropriate this time. But we have indicated to the military department we're happy to keep talking with them about ways to help meet that goal, and we certainly will continue those conversations going forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
Scott, I just wanted to make sure I understood. Did you say that only 20% of the 20 megawatts generated by solar actually ends up being electricity that can be utilized, or what did you say? You said 17 to 20%. Could you go over that again?
Of course. Representative Whitsitt, Chair Bailey, with the basically each technology has their capacity factor. So you have a couple rules of thumb, and you know, people may dispute exactly what I'm assigning to solar, but generally wind is about 30 to 33% in the Northwest. Solar, again, depending on exactly where it's sited and, you know, the quality of the system, the capacity factor for those projects can be anywhere from 15, maybe 25 at the high end. But that's how much actual energy you will get against its total capacity. So say it's 100 megawatts, generally you would get 17 to 20 average megawatts of production that you can rely on out of that system. So the systems for a lot of non-dispatchable renewable technologies tend to have a lot more capacity than what they actually produce. It's just the nature of those technologies.
It just seems like a tiny amount when you're saying it's this amount and then the capacity's 80% less than that. I mean, maybe there's a better way that we all should be viewing these renewable energy resources. How does that compare to, say, coal, for example, electricity that's generated from coal? Or what is the highest and best in terms of retaining the energy in the that's produced?
Chair Bailey, Representative Whitsitt. Coal is a dispatchable resource. You can turn it on, you can turn it off. You know, I think the average capacity factor of a large coal facility is around 80 to 85%. They're always on. It's what's called baseload. Baseload's generally anything over 60, 65%. So those types of technologies, you know, will run pretty consistently. You know, wind, solar, you know, we can't control when it's windy. We can't control when the sun's up. And so, you know, those are what are called intermittent resources because they're not always on. And so, you know, we find ways to mesh everything together to make it work.
Can I follow up? Where does hydroelectric fall into that?
It really depends on the resource.
Let's keep this discussion germane to this bill, please.
Yeah. hydro can run anywhere from a baseload resource for a large facility to a more intermittent level because it's run of the river. So it can be all across the range depending on what type of resource.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peters.
Thank you. I had a question about, I know that this isn't your bill, but I had a question about lines 24 and 25. It talks about the electric utility serving fewer than 25,000 customers in the state that has headquarters located in another state. Who falls under that?
That's code for Idaho Power.
Okay. That's what I wondered.
Okay. Seeing no further questions. Oh, Representative Benz. Under the wire.
Yes, sorry, Mr. Chair. Just so I'm understanding, the way the bill reads, I'm remembering now going back to 2009, why I think I do recall why the 5 megawatts was in there, but the way this reads, the companies are obligated to have 40 megawatts, and then if we drop down to line 17, the minimum generating capacity for each, actually let's try to drop down to line 20, the minimum generating capacity for each company under subsection 1BB of this section is determined by multiplying 20 megawatts by a fraction. Does that get around the fact that the real of the generation is something less than, I mean, you work off the nameplate, you don't work off actual generation?
Representative Benz, this language, I believe, is trying to apportion that 20 megawatts between Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp based on our loads.
Right, follow up. Right, but which 20 megawatts? Is it the nameplate or is it the actual generation? Because you were saying...
The nameplate.
It's the nameplate. Follow, please. So I'm just trying to get at, for the net zero program, this is inadequate, but for the fact that we wouldn't be getting a true 20 megawatts, we'd be getting something less than that by virtue of it being solar. And that brings me to a question. What does this cost the ratepayers? What's the excess cost to the ratepayers of this arrangement? How much are your two companies, the ratepayers, are you two companies paying as a result of this bill that they wouldn't otherwise be paying should you do it, acquire this type of nameplate capacity from some other place?
Chair Bailey, Representative Benz, it's hard to put a precise number on it because we don't know what they would bid in or what they would offer at. Okay. What I would say is that there's a couple factors when we looked at this bill. I mean, the first is the extreme limitation of the universe of where we would be buying that 20 megawatts from. So it really is a seller's market under this bill, and that causes us concern for costs. The other piece is that both of our companies are pretty far along in meeting our requirements under the RPS. So this would require us to go beyond what we already have invested in to meet the state's renewable goals. So that would be an additional cost. So these are considerations that would be above and beyond. Not to mention that solar, as we've experienced in our first 20 megawatts that we're currently acquiring, is one of the higher cost resources in our portfolio. Because it's the larger scale, it's been lower cost solar versus smaller systems that we've seen out there. But compared to other resources that we would otherwise be acquiring, and especially the avoided cost of say natural gas or hydro that we would be purchasing, it's quite a bit more. So there would be a substantial difference in the cost of this bill if it were law.
Follow up, I mean,
please.
The my understanding of solar is it's dropping dramatically in price, and my understanding further under what we just discussed is it's not a full 20 megawatts that you'd be purchasing. You're not buying the nameplate, you're buying actual production. And so it's important that we understand what that delta is, a space that we don't need an exact number, but perhaps you can share with us an estimate on under today's lower rates, if this was some of the other places you might be negotiating with right now. I just need to know what that premium is that would be required by virtue of this bill.
Representative Benz, one distinction in your question is that we wouldn't be just buying the output, we would likely be buying the capacity. We would be buying the project or doing a power purchase agreement with the project. So regardless of how much it produced, we would be paying for what we could settle to terms on the project. It would be just like any other generating resource. Like as I said, solar is probably the higher end of the stack. If you looked at, you know, coal, gas, hydro, wind, you know, if you looked at where the technologies are pricing out, solar would be on the higher end of that.
One last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're not buying the power produced. You're going to be buying the plant itself. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we'd be buying the power produced, but we wouldn't be buying basically each kilowatt hour produced. We would have a contract with the project, hopefully levelized to what we think the production would be. But I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, if you know, we have an opportunity cost there. We will buy up to the capacity of the project. We don't get to not pay for it when it's nighttime. We would pay for it through the length of a power purchase agreement over a number of years.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon.
Every once in a while, I think I'm starting to understand this. Let me put on my Jeff Bissonette hat. If you buy electricity under this type of an agreement, which is a higher cost source of power for you, is that, how do you recover that cost, or is there a cost shift that might be shifted over to some other class of ratepayers?
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon, this will absolutely go into the company's rates. If it's a power purchase agreement, then it's a straight pass-through. Whatever the costs are will go straight to customers. If it's some kind of arrangement where we end up owning the resource, it'll be rate-based. Either way, it will be fully reflected in the cost to our customers and across all rate classes, because this is generation and every customer, whether residential, commercial, or industrial, uses the generation resources of its utility.
Thank you.
The testimony from the previous panel indicated that the output of the potential facility is, I can't remember the exact figure that they used, but a small part of the overall system capacity for the utilities. Can you explain how rates are impacted by something that is theoretically a relatively small part of the system?
And we should probably each answer that, because it would be a little bit different for our companies. We're talking about 20 megawatts here. Pacific Corp's total portfolio over six states is about 10,500 megawatts. So 20 megawatts is pretty small compared to that overall portfolio. However, public policy like this, a new mandate in Oregon, would be borne by our customers only in Oregon. We have no obligation to spread those costs to five other states. So it will narrow that impact. So 20 megawatts of an expensive resource across 550,000 customers in Oregon starts to show up. It starts to get expensive. And when we compare that resource to what we otherwise would have incurred or provided service to those customers, or would have done to just serve all of our customers under the six-state arrangement that we have, it becomes quite a bit more than they otherwise would have experienced.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I would generally agree with what Scott said. I think, you know, we're in a general rate case right now where we're asking for an increase in rates, and I think that when we are looking at managing costs for customers, there's a lot of upward pressure generally on rates right now, whether it's meeting, you know, this potential new expanded mandate, other policies that the state has put in, simply meeting load. PG continues to have, unlike some utilities, you know, some load growth, and we're a short utility, so we're making investments in new facilities. We're working on a transmission line. We have, you know, two RFPs out for gas plants now, and another one for renewables. There's, at some point, it's the pancaking of all the different things that we're trying to manage those costs. And, you know, while something seems small, all these things together begin to add up, and it's a lot to try to balance those pressures on rates.
Okay. Thank you both very much. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on House Bill 2941? Seeing no one, close the public hearing on House Bill 2941. Anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, soon we'll be printing energy.
Thank you, Representative Widener. Oh, that's right. Sorry, we have one more thing to take care of. Do you have a motion?
Chair, I'd like to suspend rules and allow Representative Dembrough to cast his vote on House Bill 2266. It will not change the outcome.
Vice Chair Johnson requests unanimous consent in order to suspend the rules to allow Representative Dembro to cast a vote on House Bill 2266. Is there objection? Hearing none. Motion carries. Representative Dembro, how do you vote?
Aye.
Dembro votes aye. And House Bill 2266 is still on its way to the floor. And we are adjourned.
Amazing.